Have you heard about Global Poker? Global Poker is the fastest growing card room in the US today, and it's available online at globalpoker.com. Global Poker is a social poker site that offers safe and secure cash out options by using their unique and patented sweepstakes model. Players can compete in big guaranteed tournaments, jackpot sit and goes, or cash games featuring Hold'em, Omaha, and even Crazy Pineapple. Don't wait. Check out Global Poker today.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Hello and welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 96, and it features longtime poker professional Mark Gregorich. Mark is 50 years old, and he has been playing poker for a living since the mid-90s. But before that, he was actually a high school history teacher. In fact, Mark would have continued to be a teacher, just like his mother, father, and brother, if he hadn't lost his job over budget cuts. Facing a year of unemployment, Mark moved to Las Vegas and his career in poker officially started. In the years that followed, he worked his way up to some of the biggest cash games in the city and was considered by his peers to be the best Omaha 8 or better player around. In fact, his reputation in the game was so great that Doyle Brunson asked him to contribute to the game section of Super System 2. Mark has always been more of a cash game grinder, preferring to set his own hours at his home base of Bellagio. But although he has yet to win a WSOP bracelet, he does have a stellar tournament record at the Summer Series with 11 final tables on his resume. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here's my conversation with one of the nicest guys in poker, Mark Gregorich. All right, I am here with the one and only Mark Gregorich. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
You know, I'm hanging in there. You know, it's the summer. And the World Series is technically going on, but you know, things obviously feel different. You spent the summer on a road trip, huh?
We were gone for a couple weeks. My daughter just finished her junior year at University of Washington in Seattle, so we flew up and picked her up and rented an SUV and kind of did some national park touring for a couple weeks. Went to Glacier in Montana, which was amazing, and from there did the long drive down to the Redwoods and then over to Yosemite before finally getting back to Vegas.
That's a lot of time in a small enclosed place with your family. It worked out okay? Everyone loves each other?
Four of us 24/7 for a couple weeks, and that didn't have to go well, but it did. We all got along really well and had a good time, and it was fun. We tried to stay in some places where we could kind of shop and cook for ourselves rather than be out, and that was a good time. My daughter likes to cook and I like to cook, so we did a lot of kind of joint meals and played some games, hung out, enjoyed the beautiful country where we were, and it was a nice trip.
What was the highlight of the trip as far as the sights?
Well, I mean, I would say the whole trip, all that the kids were talking about is wanting to see a bear. And we knew our best shot was going to be at Glacier. And we saw some elk, but nothing resembling a bear. So that was kind of a bummer.
Be careful what you wish for.
Obviously, yeah, there's obviously like ways that you want to see a bear and ways that you really don't want to see a bear. I mean, we didn't want to, like, when we were alone on a isolated trail, we didn't really want to see like cubs right in front of us. But, that wasn't kind of what we had in mind. From a safe viewing distance. We didn't get to see one there. We didn't see anything at the Redwoods. Just wasn't really expecting it there. So our last shot was Yosemite. And we'd done a few hikes and done some, you know, touristy stuff, whatever, and didn't see any. And then we were going to do one more trail that we thought would have a shot at seeing it. And then we we couldn't find any parking. I mean, it was a little more crowded than I was expecting, to be honest. We may not have done all this. I mean, it wasn't wall-to-wall people or anything, and people were, you know, for the most part, keeping their distance from each other.
Everyone suddenly has vacation time.
But yeah, there was a lot of that. So we couldn't find parking, so we basically just threw in the towel, and we're driving back to our cabin, and we decided, we saw like some random trail on the side of the road. We decided to, why not? Let's do it. And, you know, sure enough, we weren't that far down, and there was like a berry patch, and there he was, in there, you know, snacking away, completely oblivious to us. So we watched him eat for a while, and that was fun. And that was, our trip was complete.
And now he's mounted in your living room over the fireplace?
No, I mean, we were going to take like a feces, you know, souvenir from him, but we couldn't find any.
All right. Let's go back to the beginning. Before poker was even in your thoughts, did you grow up in Washington?
Yeah, I grew up in Olympia, Washington. And I lived there until I was like 25.
Yeah, born and raised. What was the family life like? Any brothers or sisters?
We have a pretty quiet, small family. I have one brother who's 3 years younger than me, and my parents are both grade school teachers. My brother's...
There it is.
Yeah. My brother's a high school teacher in town. He's been doing that for a long time in Vegas, and... I taught high school for 3 years before.
Well, that's why I ask, because it seems like teachers breed teachers, you know?
Yeah. 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 That was definitely the case in our family. I mean, I never really had any thought of doing anything other than teaching. And then, you know, now here I am.
So you were, even as a kid, you were like looking up to mom and dad saying, that's what I was going to do. Or was it like, it's a fallback?
I just think it's kind of natural if you have a good relationship with your parents and you kind of, you know, you sort of model yourself after them a little bit, that you're at least going to check out what they're doing. And mm-hmm. It always seemed like a good fit for me. And I had some, you know, really good teachers coming up in high school. I had a few teachers that I thought kind of left a real good mark on me. And I think it kind of the combination of, you know, my upbringing plus having some real influential teachers in my life kind of led me in that direction. And, you know, once I hit college, I much just went with that path. I didn't really look around too much. I briefly thought about pre-med. But I took like this chemistry class, and we had these like early morning labs, and I got major headaches from the goggles. So it's kind of like the combo of having to get up so early and getting headaches. I know that's kind of a flimsy excuse, but that was enough for me.
I showed up to college pre-med as well, and I couldn't pass my first chemistry class. So I think the goggles is at least more respectable than just being ill-equipped mentally.
I'm not sure about that. It might just no pain tolerance.
Yeah. So, okay, you're in school, you know, working towards becoming a teacher, which you eventually do. Are you discovering poker at this time, or was poker like a kitchen table thing growing up? Or
I had already discovered it. Basically, so my best friend growing up, his dad played in these 18 and over card rooms in Washington. We had a lot of like public small deal yourself rooms that you had to be 18 to play in. It's pretty crazy thinking about some of those rooms now, just compared to how poker's come along.
Washington was notorious for tiny little card rooms, like one and two table rooms everywhere.
They were absolutely everywhere. And they were all just like, I mean, complete, everybody smoked, everybody dealt themselves. So, you know, I mean, anybody that was kind of halfway adept at being a mechanic with the cards was probably going to do pretty well in the game. So we kind of learned these games that they played from my friend's dad. He taught us when we were like, you know, 15, 16. And I mean, he taught us Omaha High Low. He taught us Crazy Pineapple. Taught us Seven Card Stud High Low Split. No Hold'em yet, but we learned those split games.
And this was late 80s, early 90s?
Like probably, I would want to say about 86.
Yeah.
So anyway, we started playing, you know, and we basically played on rainy days in Washington. So we played probably 6 days a week. And we would just get together after school and play for a few hours. And our group started growing. And like by the time we hit like, say, junior and senior year, we'd have a poker game one night every weekend, either at my buddy's house or at my house. And we often had like two tables. And it was kind of, you know, it was a dealer's choice, and there was a lot of crazy games, and we kind of made up new games and everything, but that was kind of how it started. And we were kind of obsessed with it after that. And then at 18, oh, go ahead.
I was just wondering, how do you become obsessed with a game that you don't see on TV? You know, it's not like you knew about the characters in Vegas, the ones that happened to be there. I mean, I had rounders, I had online poker, and I had, you know, whole card cameras to get me hooked. So
yeah, I mean, in our case, it was just the interaction and the personal experience. I mean, I grew up, like, we played games constantly as a family, and so I was always a big game guy, and this was just another extension of that. And of course, the, you know, the added element of the action was something that appealed to all of us. I mean, we all had jobs for $3.50 an hour or something, so we had, like, you know, pocket change to play these games.
Were you good right away?
No, I was terrible. I couldn't keep a straight face if I was trying to bluff. Like, everybody always knew when I turned red that I was bluffing. And I mean, I didn't really think about the strategy that much. I was just kind of seat of my pants in it. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't aggressive enough. So, I mean, I gradually became better. But, you know, like, our game was, I mean, it was a bunch of high school kids having fun, but everybody took it dead serious also. And it was a lot of it was really competitive people. Like, our game was always like the nerdy guys that were really smart and the athlete types. So it was like people that were good at whatever, and everybody just had a good time with it, but it was super competitive also. So I remember a couple nights driving home after I lost like $20, and it was like the end of the world.
All the money in the world, for sure. So at what point do you think, I'm good at this and maybe I could make some money on the side?
Well, that happened once we turned 18, we started going to these card rooms. And I mean, these people that played in these card rooms were just absolutely awful. So I don't think I was good, but I was better than they were from day one. And I mean, like, the first time I walked in, I think I won like $150. And I mean, that was that.
Yeah.
I mean, I never had like that kind of money. And so that was like in the summer after my senior year. So I had a few months to kill before college. And I went and played probably 4 or 5 nights a week, and probably 3 or 4,000 in that time. You know, it's a lot of cash for some random kid that had making $3.50 an hour otherwise. So yeah, I mean, after that I decided to take it kind of seriously. I mean, it was on hold during college. I didn't play while I was going to school, but I would play a lot in the summers and on vacations.
Yeah, I was about to say, there was nothing going to stop you from getting that degree, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was no internet poker, so I know that was like a degree deterrent for a lot of the next generation. But in my case, no. I mean, I didn't really think about playing much while I was at school. I enjoyed college a lot and had some good friends there, and none of them were interested in poker. So I just kind of stuck to, you know, school stuff. But when I was home for like winter break or summer vacation, I played constantly.
So you graduate and you take a job. Was it high school?
Yeah.
So did
I taught high school history.
History, okay. And what was that like? Was it what you expected? Did you find that you were good at it? What was that like?
Yeah, I loved it. And I think I was pretty good at it. I mean, obviously, the more, after some experience, you get better at certain aspects of it. But, you know, like, kind of the whole classroom management side of things, was the part that they don't really teach you much in college, but you have to learn to deal with efficiently, or you're just going to get run over. So I got that part down pretty quickly, which was nice. And then I enjoyed it. I had a good time with the job. There was enough flexibility in the way I could teach. I tried to do a lot of creative stuff, rather than just, you know, workbooks type, you know, things. So I was more of like a project guy, and the kids seemed to respond pretty well to it for the most part. So yeah, it was really enjoyable. And
I'll say you were 22.
Yeah.
And these kids are 17, 18 in some spots.
Yeah, some of them are. Right. Yeah.
I mean, so that's a tough situation to command respect.
Yeah. One thing I did was I wore a tie every day, which I hate ties too, but I've worn them these days. If I wear a tie, it's either somebody's dead or somebody's getting married. That's like the only two reasons. But back then, I mean, like, it was, I thought it was necessary to, you know, obviously create some sort of separation from the students. And then also, like, if I'm walking around the hall, I don't want somebody asking me for my hall pass. So I want to have I want to dress a little different.
Someone put the new teacher in detention.
So,
all right.
Yeah,
so
I did get asked to the prom a few times.
That's another issue as well.
Which obviously, yeah, it didn't stop all my colleagues. I know of a couple, but anyway, I did get asked to the prom. I know one time I got asked to like her senior prom, and of course I said no. And then literally the day after graduation, she's in there and like, well, now I'm out.
Brutal. Brutal. What's a 22-year-old to do? Anyway, you did that for 3 years?
Yeah.
So was it just that poker was so lucrative? You couldn't give it up, or was it a matter of, you know?
No, it was actually a district thing. I was never going to really consider leaving, but our district had a failed levy, which so we had kind of a funding crisis. And one of the responses to the crisis was they laid off all teachers with 3 years or less seniority in a subject areas in mind. So I got the axe, at least temporarily. And I mean, they basically said, you know, you're probably gonna be out this year, and we'll hire you back next year. So that was kind of what I was left with. So I had like a year to play around with, and obviously I was gonna play poker with that year.
If you don't mind me asking, how much did you make as a teacher versus how well were you doing in the games?
Yeah, so I think my starting teacher salary back in the day, this is like 1992, 93, was like $22,000.
Wow.
I did a couple, yeah. And I did a couple other things. Like I coached and was involved with like some club stuff. So I probably got 28 as a teacher.
Yeah. That's just three bullets now.
And yeah, I know. It's crazy. So I was probably already making more playing than I was teaching, in kind of a fraction of the time. I was playing in the summer and playing, like, I would play occasionally on a weekend or, you know, or my school breaks. So, yeah, the money wasn't really close. But, I mean, I kind of always thought I was just going to stay in this job that I liked and play poker on the side, like in the summers or whatever, to, you know, as supplemental income. And be perfectly happy doing that. And I'm sure I would have been. But when I got laid off, I kind of, that changed my sort of attitude a little bit. I was a little bitter about it. I saw like a lot of the teachers that were basically, you know, had basically mailed it in, but they were still working and I wasn't. I wasn't.
Seniority.
I was a little unhappy that, you know, just kind of how it's prioritized in our society and all this. And it was kind of a wake-up call that, you know, if you are involved in a job like this, I mean, it can just be basically taken from you at any time. Just the combination of all those things kind of made me decide I wanted to give poker a shot and see if that was something, you know, if I could just sort of be my own boss, basically, rather than sort of be at the mercy of politics or society. So that was kind of my attitude at the time. And I decided to enroll in a master's program at UNLV and move to Vegas to go to school for that off year and play poker and just kind of see how it went and not really make a firm commitment to going back to Washington, but also have, you know, of course, I have that safety net that they would hire me back at some point.
Right.
So I wasn't, you know, so if I totally bombed out, I did have something to fall back on at least.
Right. So when you first got to town, what was the game you were in?
So I started playing in two spots. I kind of split my time between the Horseshoe and the Mirage. The Horseshoe had like a, I want to say it was 30-60 Omaha high-low game that I played as often as it went, basically. And it was a good game and pretty soft and had a lot of, I mean, played with a lot of guys that are still around. Played with Mike Sexton a lot, got to be friends with him then. You know, Scotty Wynn was a regular in the game at the time. Yeah, there's some other guys too. And then the Mirage game, I mostly played 20-40 limit hold'em.
Now, this is pre-boom. You know, tournaments aren't really that popular, at least with the top pros. And, you know, no limit hold'em isn't what it is today. So what did these games look like? Was it just easy pickings? Or was it, you know, a struggle to find action?
No, it wasn't really. There was plenty of action. I mean, a few things. I mean, poker hadn't taken off, so there wasn't nearly as many players, you know, in the world. But there also weren't very many places to play. So when people wanted to play poker, they came to Vegas, or they would, you know, or they'd go to Atlantic City. There just weren't very many options. So there was kind of a steady stream of tourists going in. Like these days, there's, you know, people can play locally, they can play on the internet, they can play all over. So there's really not much reason for people to go to Vegas anymore outside of the World Series of Poker when that was a thing. So we end up getting, you know, kind of like a kind of roving group of rotating cast of people from out of town. Guys would come in and play for a week and leave. And there would always be three or four of those guys in the game. And that was just totally standard then. And they're also like the games were just, I mean, I wasn't very good, but I was a lot better than the competition. People just weren't good at poker at all back then. Mm-hmm. It's so different now.
Now, was it a matter of, you know, just finding the game that was the weakest, or did you have a preference?
No, I pretty much just played the same thing all the time. I played in that Omaha game with the Horseshoe, which was one, sometimes two tables. And I knew what time it started, and I always got there, you know, a little before it started to make sure I got a seat, and I would just play all day. I didn't really have a agenda. So I would do that, and then on the times where there wasn't a game and I wanted to play, I would go to the Mirage and play the 20-40 limit hold'em, which I was really bad at, but I still managed to win a little bit at it.
Now, was the reason you were going to the Mirage because of a certain lady named Mary?
yeah, that's right. She was a dealer at the Mirage, and we were kind of friendly. And I mean, we didn't start dating for a while. I think we started dating in 97 when I moved there in 95. But you know, we knew each other a little bit before.
Sorry, you broke up there.
Oh, no, I was done.
Yeah, I was just curious. You know, obviously you meet your wife at the poker table. I had no idea how often I had worked alongside Mary at various poker events. And the fact that she basically has more poker screen time than you do. It's kind of
nice.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, for those who don't know, she was, you know, in the box for like Poker After Dark, High Stakes Poker, the NBC Heads Up, the Poker Superstars Invitational. So if you've seen poker on TV, you've probably seen Mark's wife dealing a bad beat or two.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, she dealt all those shows. And I mean, they still rerun them all the time. So Mary will always get like 3-4 texts every time one of her shows is on.
That's great. So, all right, so let's go back to Omaha, this game that you're crushing, because for a while, or I guess it was a decade ago, they ran a survey and you came out as the best Omaha 8 or better player on earth.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, that was a long time ago. That was probably 15 years ago or something, where they did those surveys. They weren't very scientific. I mean, nobody really knew anything. Everybody just kind of had, it was just reputation.
Well, whatever. Who better than a jury of your peers?
Yeah, no, it was nice. I mean, it was cool to be recognized like that, for sure. I mean, that made me happy.
So what was it about your game that put you far and above everyone else at the time? Was it just that much fundamental mistakes being made by other players?
I mean, I think that's part of it. I think I was just really solid. I didn't give away money ever.
If anything, I was a little too much on the tight side, and I know that's kind of been, you know, my reputation, but in Ring Game Omaha, where people are playing really loose, I mean, that's how you're supposed to play, I think. And yeah, I was solid. I didn't really, you know, I got value out of my hands too. Like I knew when to check raise and, you know, all those kind of things. And I mean, the competition was fairly weak. Like I wasn't playing in the nosebleed games or anything. I mean, I was playing in, you know, whatever the, I guess that stretch, I mean, we had like a regular 75-150 type Omaha high-low game. And it's kind of interesting because, I mean, that was always, I remember for a little while when the Bellagio started and we had that game every day, it was kind of a who's who cast now. Like it had like,
yeah,
you know, Daniel would play, Mattisau, Jennifer, Todd Brunson, Sexton, who else? I think Gus Hansen played with us for quite a while. David Benjamin, you know, all these guys that are kind of like, you know, made it big during the poker room, basically. So we had an interesting game, but I always did pretty well in that lineup. So I guess that's maybe where that came from. But yeah, I mean, it's a good game. I had a lot of experience at it. I mean, that's kind of where I started when I was a kid, and played a ton of hands, and it was always my game of choice. So it just was normal that was kind of my best game.
I heard in another interview you mentioning that the Omaha games were dying out quite literally because the player pool was dying out.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, that is what happened. I mean, we had a, like around the time when the Bellagio opened, I mean, we just had a great Omaha game, one, sometimes two tables, but I think more than half the guys that were regulars in that game have passed away, which is, most of them were older, but I mean, a few of them weren't. It was a little bit, you know, surprising. And then of course, you know, when the poker boom happened, that kind of finished it off because some guys that were playing Omaha gravitated towards No Limit. And I actually didn't, which was, I'm sure, a mistake. I just went back to playing more Limit Hold'em, which also kind of had a, you know, a renaissance of its own and was massive for a while, but it would have been, but No Limit would have been probably the right way to go.
Well, I think getting ahead of the mixed game curve for today, especially when live poker comes back, might have been a good move as well. What was it like writing for Doyle for Super System 2?
Yeah, that was cool. That was like, I guess of all the things I've kind of done in poker, I mean, I've basically just been a cash game grinder for my career. I've played a few tournaments, but haven't had all that much success.
We'll get to your tournaments.
Yeah, that'll just be that little snippet at the end. So getting asked to write a chapter in Super System was like a great honor, and I was like thrilled to take part and be a part of that. And I've always actually really enjoyed writing, so it was sort of it felt like a good fit also. And yeah, I was pretty happy with how it turned out.
So you didn't feel concerned that you were giving away any trade secrets or anything like that?
I mean, there's a big difference between knowledge and application sometimes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I wasn't too concerned about that. I mean, obviously it's kind of silly to even think that way now with all the information that's out there. Like, I mean, it's a little late to be holding.
Yeah,
back.
Well, I remember, you know, there was a time when Eric Seidel didn't want to show his hole cards because he was so afraid of teaching the world how he played poker. So,
yeah, well, I don't blame Eric for that. Eric's so far ahead of most players that he could probably really give away some damaging information there.
Okay, so you disparaged your tournament record, but I think 99% of the world would trade, you know, poker resumes with you. You're right that you've been focusing on cash games, but I just want to go through your WSOP final tables alone. You have a fourth, an eighth, a second, a third, another fourth, a sixth, another fourth, a third, a fifth, another third, and another sixth. So let's not pretend that you're some sort of like tournament, down at the bottom of the tournament rankings. Absolutely not.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've done okay. I mean, I would like to, I guess like having a first in there would make me feel a lot better about how I've done. So, and I'm actually a little irritated with Negreanu about that because I was like his tag team partner a couple years ago and he was supposed to get me my first bracelet and it only ended up being one of my thirds.
That's right. He could have got it done for you and got his his seventh, which he's been going after for a while.
I promise you, while that final table was going on, I heard about it from absolutely everybody.
Which one of those was the particularly tough one to swallow? I mean, obviously, every pro wants a bracelet, right?
Yeah, it had to be the second. I still remember that one pretty well. Like a lot of these final tables. They all sort of blend together. But I think the second one was the toughest, the second place.
All right, let me say this is a 5,000 limit hold'em. And this was back in Binion's, 2003.
Yeah, moneymaker.
Wow, okay, yeah. So look at this final three. David Chu finished third. And the guy who got you heads up was Carlos, Mr. Mortensen.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a fun tournament. I mean, this is back when there were only 2 days and you basically played a final table plus on day one. So I think we came back with only like, I don't know, maybe 15 people or something. And it was long. We played really late the night before and we played really late that day. The structure was like, I remember it being really slow. And I remember Carlos and I both came in pretty short. But the structure allowed us to sort of bide our time and pick our spots pretty well. And, you know, we both kind of chipped up and then, I mean, I always figured David would win it cause David's just amazing at limit hold'em and always seems to win these, but somehow three-handed, he ran pretty poorly, I remember. And I think I busted him and, you know, he was like, come on, you gotta win this. And, Carlos and I played a long time and I know it was kind of topsy-turvy. And I know one time, I think I had aces and he had a flush draw and he basically had like half a bet left. But he made the flush on the river. Mm. And after that, I don't think I won another chip. So it was like, it was a pretty big swing. And I remember at the time, like I wasn't super disappointed, but I definitely didn't feel like I'd just won a bunch of money. I mean, that was my best score in poker so far. And I remember mostly just being kind of disappointed after. And then I was back at noon for the main event. And that was probably the TV moment everybody tells me about all the time when it's on is like, I get two outed on the river by this Irish cop, like five spots out of the money, in a pretty big pot. And he just lets out this huge, after the pot.
I remember
and
that.
The card comes. Yeah, yeah. And then, like, Norman Chad saying they're going to have to carry Grigorich out on a gurney, you know. It was, yeah.
That's funny.
So that was a fun few days. But anyway, that was probably my most, I guess that was my most memorable one.
Was 2003. You finish heads up and you think, well, if I... if I got a second place under my belt, I'm definitely going to win one of these bracelets at some point, right? Is this something that you feel like a monkey on your back, or is it just if it happens, it happens?
I'm pretty much if it happens, it happens. I'm sure it'll probably feel better than I'd like to admit it'll feel if I actually win one at some point. I don't know. It used to be like a real source of frustration for me. Like, I remember my very first World Series, the first Omaha 8 event that I played. I'm like, if I don't finish at least top three here, I'm just going to be, I'm worthless. And then I like busted in like 4 hours and I'm like, what just happened? That's tournaments. And obviously, like, I think I'm playing tournaments better now than I used to, or I haven't really been playing any lately, but last year I thought I played pretty well at the series. I know tournaments are a lot tougher than they used to be too. So it's definitely not easy to win one, but I think I'm willing to put myself out there and give it a shot.
Now, we mentioned that you've been focusing mostly on cash games all this time. You're also doing so while raising a family. Was poker different for you once you were married and had kids, or did you just approach it the same way?
It was different. Definitely started feeling like, after having kids, buying a house, getting married, it was like the first time I'd actually started feeling like the, kind of financial crunch of living. And that definitely changed my level of enjoyment for poker a little bit. I never liked to lose, but now, like, if I lost, I also kind of felt like sometimes if you have, you're on a losing streak or something, you kind of feel this like panic about, what happens if I can't win anymore. And, if I keep losing, I'm going to go broke. Mm-hmm. So, it definitely changed the dynamic. I always think poker's like great if you're unattached and don't really have like the financial pressure. Trying to play while you have like a pretty big nut and not a lot of room for error is definitely takes a lot of the enjoyment out of it for sure.
Well, do you think that's what kept you out of Bobby's room all these years? Like just not having the ability to take bigger shots? Because obviously to anyone else listening, you're a high stakes player. There's no doubt about it, but there's that one game.
I don't know, a combination of things. I mean, frankly, like I probably, at least these days, I probably just don't have the ability that a lot of those guys do. That's not to say I couldn't like work really hard and get there that way. But to balance that kind of hard work with having a family, and it's tough to do. And I chose not to really pursue that. I was pretty happy at the level I was playing, which was kind of like anywhere from say 75, 150 to 2 and 400. I was always pretty happy in that range. And
yeah, you've made it. It's crazy to think above, but some people, their eyes get big. They gotta
have I don't really have the gamble in me, or the complete no fear that you kind of need to go play those games. Like, some of these guys are just animals. They're mm-hmm. just willing to go, lay it all out there and play. And they're also like hyper competitive and they want to play against the best and show that they're better than them. And those things, those aren't really me. I've been happy playing the level I've been playing. I'm glad I can, have a nice life, and it's been a good experience for me. And, it's been maybe a little more calm for home life than if I tried to play higher. It's also like there's also a natural progression. Like, if I was absolutely demolishing 2 and 400, I'm sure I would have, played higher and see how that goes. And if I was demolishing that, I'm sure I would end up in Bobby's room. I think that's just natural. I always like did, okay at those limits or fine, but not anything that made me think I really wanted to, play 2 and 4,000.
Well, you mentioned Bobby's room. A lot of people have great Bobby's room careers that only last 4 or 5 years. There's something to be said for the longevity of being in the game for 30. So
yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's. I mean, there's also some of these guys in Bobby's room that have been in there for 30 and have been successful.
Well, of course, yeah.
Have adapted and, you know, done really well. So, like, I mean, I don't know. They have all my respect as poker players, for sure.
The consensus on you, Mark, is that you're one of the nicest guys in poker. In fact, I ask about you and people will just say that quote. He's one of the nicest guys in poker. A pro's pro, I hear a lot. Yeah, even my boss, Jeff Shulman, thinks that you get better action because of how friendly you are at the table. Do you buy into that?
I don't know. I mean, I think in Jeff's case, he just thinks he can bluff me, so I get better action from him. I don't know.
But yeah, like, you know, do you find yourself just playing better in a friendly game, or... Is it more like kill him with kindness kind of thing?
There's, I mean, that's not really my intention. It's just kind of how I am, I guess. I mean, that's not really part of my like game plan. It's just kind of, I don't know. In general, I'm kind of a easygoing, not looking for conflict type of guy. And you know, I guess that just kind of goes with it.
All right. Do you have any poker enemies? Any feuds?
Not really. I mean, yeah, I've had like very few blow ups at the table. I mean, I've had a few arguments here and there, but not too much. I mean, I did throw cards at Sam Grizzle one time. That was probably
really?
my biggest moment.
Let's hear the story. So what did Sam do to deserve that?
Well, no, I don't think he deserved it. I was kind of snapped. Sam has a way of getting under people's skin for sure. And, I mean, there should be like a book of Sam Grizzle quotes. I mean, he's got some great lines. he's one of the, you know, funniest poker players you'll run into. And it's usually like funny in like a mean, biting, sarcastic sort of way. So he definitely has a way of getting under people's skin, but it's also pretty amusing to play with Sam. I played with him a ton over the years and we've for the most part gone along really well since. Maybe we've gotten along better since I threw cards at him. But no, we were just playing a cash game one time and, I don't know. I think I was running good and somebody was like trying to be funny at the table and I was like laughing at their jokes and maybe it wasn't even that funny. So Sam was like, you know, calling me like a laughing hyena or something. And he just kept doing it. And finally I couldn't take it anymore. And I'm like, that's not a very big thing to snap over, but it did the job. And so I was folding my hand and I saw he had his cards like unprotected. So I just like winged my cards right into his hand. And it kind of did like a one hop off his chest. And then he just like gives this like absolutely shocked look at me. Didn't say anything. Just looks at me completely shocked. Like he couldn't believe that I was capable of that. And, you know, and after that, we were cool.
You probably stunned the whole table. Everyone's like, you broke Mark. No one breaks Mark.
Yeah, that's probably true.
They didn't even give you a penalty for that, huh?
That was probably around, like, you know, it's probably 20 years ago when that happened.
I mean, I know it's a lie.
No, they didn't give you penalties for that. I mean, they only gave you penalties, like, if you urinated on the dealer or something. I mean, there wasn't much for throwing cards.
Oh, what's the worst behavior you saw at a table in your... in your career?
There's been like, there used to be, I mean, it's one of the ways that poker has generally gotten better is that there's less tolerance for like outright dealer abuse. But back when I was starting up, man, I mean, some players were just relentless in attacking dealers. And I remember one time at the Mirage where, this guy was just cussing the dealer out, wouldn't stop, raising his voice, etc. And then, like in the same breath, the poker room manager comes up and is completely oblivious to what's going on. By the way, this is not why he's here. He's just up here to say hi because the guy's a big fish, I guess. And he taps him on the shoulder, and the guy just turns around and he's like breaks into this big smile. Hey, so good to see you. And it was one of the, I mean, people can obviously control themselves.
Yeah.
And it's just sad that that kind of behavior was allowed to go on for so long. But most rooms and most players, or some players at least, are proactive now about trying to, you know, stick up for dealers when necessary.
Absolutely. That's one of my biggest pet peeves at the table is dealer abuse. We have some rapid fire questions to close it out if you're ready.
Okay, sure.
All right. Do you remember any of your students? Do you have a worst student or a best student?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I remember some good ones for sure. And every so often, like, somebody will friend me on Facebook that I taught that I hadn't heard from in, you know, 25 years or whatever now, 30 years, long time. Jeez. Not 30, 25. I'm not that old yet. Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty cool to hear from people.
What about the biggest pot you've ever won or lost? Your choice.
Dang. This is only rapid fire if I come up with a quick answer, right?
No, you could take your time. I don't think once in the history of 100 episodes of this podcast has anybody done rapid fire questions rapidly.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, like, biggest pot I would have won or lost has to be in a tournament because I don't know.
Oh, yeah,
probably
the equity, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in all likelihood, the biggest pot I lost was that two outer by the Irish Cop, because if I'd have won that, I think I would have had a top 10 stack heading into the money and probably would have busted that moneymaker guy.
Yeah.
And poker's history would have all been different. So, you know, I mean, you're welcome.
Do you think the Gregorich boom has the same ring to it?
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to do something about that name. I don't know.
He had the perfect name.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah, it was great. And I mean,
it's funny because
that was really a classic final table too. Like, is the bluff against Farha, and then the big hand against Ivy. I mean, those are just classic TV poker hands.
He takes out Ivy in 10th place or 11th or something, and all the poker pros are, oh no, the guy who was gonna help poker get to the mainstream went out. And meanwhile, that made more money for Ivy than anything he could have imagined.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a good beat for Ivy, as it turned out, I think.
All right. Best swap or piece you've ever had of anybody?
I mean, I swapped with Jeff Schulman when he final tabled the main. So
which time?
That was a good. The second time when it was worth more.
Yeah, the first time, yeah, that was just pennies.
Yeah.
Got so seven that was probably, figures.
I guess that was probably my best swap.
Worked out. I've heard that you are chummy with a Oral Hershiser. Is that a poker thing or?
Has
he picked you fastballs?
He's given me hitting lessons. I mean, he was a good hitting pitcher back in the day. Yeah. He was playing poker at the Bellagio on a regular basis. And this is back, I don't know, mid-90s, I guess. Mid-2000s. And he was studying the game because that's kind of his approach to everything. And had seen me do a poker seminar on a video somewhere. I think it was like the Card Player Poker Players Conference or something that I spoke at. And so he see me and he recognized me in the poker room and introduced himself. I knew who he was already, but he introduced himself and asked me if I would help him with his poker. And I said, I was playing a lot of softball then. So I said, I want some help with my swing in return. And I don't know, both things were fairly successful. I mean, like shortly after we started doing lessons, he played in the NBC Heads Up. And that was, you know, at the time, like one of the toughest things of the year, very, very competitive, albeit very fast structure, and 64 players. And he made the Elite Eight, which was pretty cool.
Beat
some good players along the way.
Super cool.
Yeah, and then over the years we've just gotten to be good friends. Our wives get along great. So it's a good, you know, it's a good group to hang out with.
Now, I know that the Bellagio has been your home base for a while, but where's the weirdest place you've ever played poker for money?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd have to go back a little ways for that one. I don't know. I mean, I played, played a lot in backseat of cars. I played, I don't know, when I was teaching, I think it was my second year of teaching, I got in this, the card rooms up there all closed at like 2 o'clock, and like on a Friday night or something, I was playing in a home game, after hours home game that got busted. And I was kind of, I was pretty freaked out about that, because I thought that could cost me my job.
Yeah. Local teacher caught up in gambling ring.
Yeah. So, and it might have. I mean, it never made the papers, fortunately. But had it, I mean, that could have been bad news. That could have gotten me on the same career path, but a different way.
Was that your worst trip to jail?
yeah, they actually didn't take us in that night. They put us in like the cuffs, and we sat in this cold, non-heated house in January, basically for like 3 hours all night. And I was shaking pretty good, just shivering by the end of that. And then, of course, they did the, of course, it was like, I was running like God that night, which really made it even worse. I mean, it would have been one thing to get pinched when you're stuck a bunch on the sheet, but we were playing like 10, 20 hold'em, and I was ahead like 1200 or something. And
brutal.
That was a tough pill to swallow there.
You're like, somebody save the paper. Somebody. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, no, I do remember that we were on the turn of a big pot when they bust in and busted it, and everything just sat like it was. And like 2 hours later, one of the guys, I don't know, ATF or whoever busted it, I'm not even sure what group it was, and he starts flipping all these cards, and one of the other guys in cuffs said, yelled across the room after that, "Hey, you made your flush."
Oh, that's great. That's, well, you know, at least you can keep your sense of humor in that moment.
Yeah,
obviously, do? We talked about...
We were lucky it was the cops.
Yeah. We talked about teaching, but what was the worst job you had before poker?
I'm sure that was being a night stalker at the local Safeway. Where I worked from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Mopping floors and stocking shelves.
That, oh, heavy. Man.
I don't, okay. I don't think there was
stalker.
Anything to compare with that one.
I thought, yeah, you said
not
stalker.
S-T-A-L-K-E-R. No. Yeah, that would actually maybe be kind of fun. But the S-T-O-C-K-E-R part, not so much.
Yeah, fill those shelves up.
Yeah.
What was your largest non-poker wager?
I'm pretty, not too much. I'm not really like, I mean, I like golf, but I don't really play for big money on a golf course, so I don't think it would have been there. And I mean, I'm sure it was some random sports bet, but the one I remember is we were at my best friend's wedding in Melbourne, Australia, a while back. And there's this place, this little island near Melbourne, where these pigeons, or not pigeons, but penguins, every night come in from the ocean. And they always have a count on how many penguins come in on any given night. And so, of course, there was like six of us out there. And we did a pretty good size on how many penguins there were that night. And we were counting, and we were like, no, there's no way this is an accurate count. But yeah, but I remember that one. That was fun.
Betting on penguins. That's a good one. Are you a big prop bet guy or?
I'm not, but I appreciate hearing about all the good prop bets out there. I think there's some great prop bets.
But you mostly stayed away?
Yeah, it's not really my thing. I mean, I don't like to punish myself physically by, you know, doing things that the human body shouldn't do to win prop bets. And I'm not really good at handicapping them either. So I don't really want to, I just figure if I make a bet and somebody accepts, I might as well just pay them right now.
Right. That's the thing. Everyone who's proposing these bets is usually the one who has the best of it. So if you're not proposing them, you probably should stay away. Let's see here. Well, let's talk about you know, traveling. I know you're a big poker cruiser. Was that Australian trip also a poker cruise?
Yeah, no, that was just for a wedding. I got married down there. I've actually never been to Aussie Millions, but we did go to the casino in Melbourne, the Crown, when we were down there for the wedding. But yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of poker cruising. Mary and her good friend Zach, who's floor man at the World Series, started their own poker cruise company a couple years ago called Ship It. And we've had a few cruises. Obviously, it's on hiatus at the moment, and hopefully the world gets to a good enough place soon that that's even going to be an option again. But we'll see.
Yeah. Where have you been? Do you have a favorite spot?
I mean, the Caribbean ones are always nice just for a little quick getaway vacation. Probably the cruise that I remember the ports the most and enjoyed the most was Barcelona, where we spent a few days in Barcelona first, and then hit like several of the Mediterranean ports, you know, Cannes and several spots in Italy, which were great. It was kind of the only experience I've had with Italy. And I don't know, cruising gives you like a nice little taste of a lot of places. You don't really get to immerse anywhere. But it's a great way to do a vacation where you basically wake up somewhere new every day and then you have a day to explore. So I kind of like the kind of low maintenance, you know, how easy it is to just go on a cruise and see places.
Oh, traveling without dealing with planes. That's the dream.
Yeah, definitely.
I never have to get on a plane again. Let's see here. Do you like telling people you are a professional poker player?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a non-issue for me, basically. I don't have any problem telling people.
Was it an issue back in the day?
It was a little bit. I mean, I can't have to say, like, when I moved to Vegas, under the guise of going to, you know, UNLV, I mean, I knew I was mostly going to be playing poker, but that gave me like a bit of an alibi. And you know, that came in handy with, I mean, basically trying to explain the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, I always had like, you know, a few people that I was initially a little hesitant to talk to about poker, but, you know, as time's gone by, that's not really a thing anymore. It's a little late in the game for that.
Do you have a nemesis in poker, someone you can't beat or somebody who's just always held over you? Or for a stretch of time, it felt that way?
Yeah, let me think about that for a minute. I'm sure there's a few of them. I don't know. There's always been like a few people that I just thought are just so far beyond me that I just have trouble. I don't even know what to do when I'm playing with them. Because, you know, whatever I do is just going to be wrong. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely a few of those guys that I just think are, you know, just great, outstanding poker players that are always going to be a step ahead of me, no matter what I do. You know, a few of the Bobby Drum guys, I mean, like, I think Hennigan's a tremendous poker player. I always think he's just so tough to play against. And David Oppenheim's really, really strong.
Those two come up often on the show.
I played a lot with David Benjamin back in the day when we played a lot of 08, and David was like a really creative Omaha player, but like really intelligent and really was really difficult to play against. He was like one of my tougher 08 players, 08 opponents for sure.
I remember seeing him play the online nosebleed 08 game on Full Tilt back in the day. All right. Let's see. Headphones on at the table. Yes or no?
Typically no. I will wear them if there's people that I really don't want to listen to. or if it's like, you know, sometimes if it's like, I mean, a random no limit tournament that I'm playing where the whole table's wearing headphones, I'll probably just put them on too. I mean, I don't have a problem listening to music at the table every now and then. But typically speaking, like, you know, if we're playing like a mixed event at the World Series or something, I mean, I enjoy the camaraderie and being there. So I'd rather not have headphones on.
Do you have a favorite album?
Good question.
I have, I don't know if I have one. I mean, I have you a bunch
name,
of stuff. I mean,
yeah, you can name a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, I have a pretty broad music taste. I would say, like, I mean, I'm fortunate where my kids like a lot of older stuff that I like and a lot of newer stuff that they like. So
nice.
We can get along on music, and we've actually been to a lot of concerts together, which is cool. So I don't know. I think, I mean, I can just give you some bands as far as like new stuff. I saw you at the Jimmy Eat World show a few years ago. I remember that.
I did go to that gym. It was you and, Ben, you were there, right?
Yeah.
I love them. They're probably in my top five.
So John Turner was there. I see John Turner every concert I go to, like literally, he's always at every show.
That's John Pearl Jammer.
I'm there with Turner. I'm there with Ben, and I get a text from John, and it's like, dude, you should put Ben on your shoulder so he can see.
It's funny because Ben was dancing like crazy in that.
Ben has hops. He was getting up, so he was good. But yeah, so I've seen them a few times. I like their music quite a bit. I like some of the, you know, some of the classic stuff, like Radiohead, I guess, is one of my favorites, but I've never seen them. I would like to at some point. I like The National a lot.
Yes.
I like Vampire Weekend quite a bit, of all the kind of modern stuff. And then, you know, if you go back, I mean, a lot of the, you know, kind of classic rock, Fleetwood Mac, love them. Pink Floyd. And then, you know, of course, I grew up in the 80s, so I like a lot of the 80s stuff. A lot of the 80s stuff I listened to then that were my favorite stuff when I was a teenager is not the 80s stuff I would listen to now, though, I have to say.
Interesting. Yeah, I never graduated to new music. I just, whatever I was listening to in college, I just kept listening to, so I'm a little stunted, I think.
Yeah, but, no, I like the new music. I mean, I think it's... I don't know. Most good music is done by people like in their 20s for the most part. And so if you just like shut that whole thing out of your life, you're going to, I mean, I feel like you're missing out on a lot of good stuff.
Before they get too rich and out of touch with reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a favorite movie?
It's hard. It's hard to keep churning up good stuff.
Yeah.
Do I have a favorite movie? I don't know. Again, I probably have like a group of movies that I've seen a lot that I can always watch again.
We can narrow it down to gambling movie.
Yeah. I mean, Rounders, I guess, would be my favorite gambling movie. I think that's well done.
What was the, because you were a poker pro before that came out. So as a poker pro watching that, were you like, yes, this is accurate? Or were you nitpicking or, you know, was it just like, finally, somebody's telling our story?
I thought it was closer to accurate than anything else I'd seen on as a movie for sure. And yeah, I mean, I think the story was kind of compelling. I mean, obviously like there's other, like, I mean, parts of it are kind of cringeworthy, you know, as far as like, Mike's like, you know, unabashed support of Worm and just kind of like, I mean, some of the stuff's kind of, it doesn't necessarily do poker any favors, I guess, as far as an activity in general.
Yeah, the cheating scenes.
Yeah, but overall, I mean, it was great for exposure, and it was nice to have like a, you know, really solid cast in that movie. So yeah, I mean, it was good. I mean, I've watched it with the kids a few times, and I can still watch it.
Do you have a celebrity doppelganger? Or somebody that people told you look like growing up?
I mean, I guess the one I get is Brad Garrett.
Brad Garrett? Hold on, Mark, because I played golf with you, and I don't remember you being 300 pounds. Let me see here.
No, Brad Garrett? He's not 300 pounds.
He's a massive man. He's a giant.
Big. Yeah.
I'm not seeing it. Yeah. I'm not seeing it. Those people are being mean.
That's funny. Gotten it a few times. I don't know. I've gotten
okay,
Greg
you
Maddox.
Know what?
I've actually gotten Greg Maddox quite a few times too.
I'm seeing Brad when his hair's out a little bit curlier. Yeah. Okay, with the hair, I get it. let me see, Greg Maddux. I actually met Greg Maddux at a golf tournament back in the day. Him and I think Smoltz were playing a twosome.
Okay. Yeah, I was actually
supposed to golf with him
like a year ago, but it fell through. But I think that's fairly similar, right?
Okay, I'm looking at a picture of Maddux when he played with the Cubs, and it looks like you in his uniform.
Okay,
it's dead on. Okay, that one I buy way more than Brad Garrett for sure. For those of you listening,
I've actually done that with Oral before, where we'd be out to dinner or something, and some guy would come up and introduce, like, you know, say, "Wow, are you Oral?" You know, whatever. And
yeah,
he's like, "Yeah," and then he'll look at me and like, I was like, "I'm Greg Maddux."
Yeah, I mean, who would lie about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, but I would usually do Derek Jeter, but obviously that's not, I don't pull that one off as well.
Yeah, that one's tougher. All right, are you superstitious at all?
Not really, only about some little stupid stuff. Like, if I'm running good, I would always take the same route to Bellagio and always make sure the same songs are on the radio, stuff like that.
Okay. But,
you know, that's about the extent of it.
So what, like if you have a bad session, then you just take the long way home?
I do, yeah.
Well, man, think of all the extra miles over the years just because of a bad session. I like that. We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator. Let's see.
All right.
How many pairs of shoes do you own?
These are all shoes that are currently in my house, not necessarily anything I've worn anytime recently, right?
How many are in your rotation?
In my rotation? Yeah. Do flip-flops count?
Sure.
Okay. Six.
Wow. That's a man of style.
Is that a lot?
I think that's a lot.
There's two pairs of tennis shoes and one pair of flip-flops in that six.
I guess I'm not thinking about my golf shoes.
Oh, yeah.
I have an extra pair of flip-flops. I have my nice sneakers, and then I have my, you know, mess-up sneakers. But, you know, I don't have any penny loafers in my rotation, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I haven't had any in mine since March.
There you go. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing the stories.
You got it, Julio. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
That's the show. Thank you once again to Mark for coming on. Obviously, poker cruises aren't really a thing at the moment, but depending on when you are listening to this, they might be up and running. So go check out Ship It Poker Cruises and see if that's something you want to consider for your next vacation. You can also follow us on Twitter @poker_stories or @cardplayermedia. As always, please subscribe for a new Poker Stories podcast episode every 2 weeks. And if you do go the extra mile and leave a nice rating and a review, let us know you did so by sending us an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll give you a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.